Hey, welcome to React Roundup, the podcast where we keep you updated on all things React related. This show is sponsored by Raygun and produced by Top End Devs and Envoy. Top End Devs is where we create top end devs who get top end pay and recognition while working on interesting problems and making meaningful community contributions. And Envoy, which provides remote design and software development services on a task basis. So clients only pay when tasks are delivered and approved. In today's episode, we have a very special guest, which is Max Stoiber, the CEO and co-founder of Stellate, and you might know him as the creator of Styled Components. So we're going to have a very interesting show about his projects and his career progression from being a contributor as a developer to the role that he feels currently. My name is Lucas Paganini. I'm your host in the podcast. And joining me in today's episode are also the amazing hosts, Chris Fruen.
Hello, everyone.
Peter Osa.
Hi, everyone.
And just to give an opportunity to introduce himself, here is Max Stoiber.
Thank you for the beautiful intro, Lucas. That was great. I think for people that are listening in that might have been in the React ecosystem for a while, co-created way back when in 2014, 15-ish when React was first released, React Boilerplate, which at the time was maybe the best way to manage Webpack. This is now ancient technology because afterwards, very quickly, people realized that was boilerplates were maybe not the best way to do that. And Create React App came around and later, of course, Next.js and Gatsby and all these meta frameworks and Remix, of course. And then as part of that, also later on, I co-created Style Components, which is a CSS and JS library that got very widely adopted because it moved CSS closer to the components. So for people that have been in the React ecosystem for a while, you might have heard of some of these, you might have even used some of these. And later on, I transitioned to founding a startup in the graphical space called Stellate. So happy to talk about any and all of those things today.
Nice. Well, let's get started. So why don't you give us a little bit of history and context? Like, I'm sure that if I just say, let's go from the beginning, then I'm not sure if...
How much time do you have?
Do we have five hours
here?
But I'm thinking perhaps like most people are going to, at least most people listening to this episode are probably going to know you as the creator of Style Components, just because it's so widely adopted in the React community. And well, we're talking about React developers here. So perhaps we could start with that. And well, why did you create this library and how was the process of like this in itself was kind of a successful business, right? Like not necessarily bringing you money, but it was a product that you created and it you needed it to create traction. So there were many different solutions for the same problem that Style Components was solving. And for some reason, most of the developers preferred your solution. And I wonder if this was entirely organic or if there were any more directed and strategic steps from your part to make this library successful.
Yeah, Style Components came to be because I was working at a company and we were building a sort of reusable component library called Elemently UI. As part of that, we wanted to publish this component library to NPM and have other people be able to use it, right? This is, you know, sort of an internal design system that we wanted external people to be able to use. But very quickly back in those days, you started to realize that there was no very consistent way of distributing CSS with a component library because ultimately what people mostly did in those days is they used Webpack and configured it to publish CSS modules, right? Which required setting up a Webpack loader correctly with all these options. But the problem is if our users of these component library didn't use CSS modules, suddenly they had to add this Webpack configuration and it messed up all of the rest of their CSS, right? If they were doing CSS in another way, suddenly they had this extra Webpack loader that would conflict with the way that they were doing CSS and it would just break everything. And so basically the component library essentially wasn't really reusable outside of our specific use case. And so that was the initial problem that we started with. And I met Glenn Mattern, who's the co-creator of CSS modules and then co-created Style Components with me. And we started talking about this problem. And we realized that there had been this, at the time, recent new innovation around moving CSS into JavaScript. Particularly, JSS was one of the first libraries to do this really and bring this to popularity. And the the thing that we didn't like about all the existing libraries at that point is that they forced you to write CSS as JavaScript objects, as not JSON, but like as objects in JavaScript, right? And we loved CSS, and we still do love CSS. And the problem with moving it into objects, and what most of these libraries did, attach it as inline styles, is that you lose a lot of the CSS power, right? You couldn't do media queries, you couldn't do hover states, you had to alias a lot of that in JavaScript, and it was sort of a very complex way of doing the thing that the browser can already do with CSS. And so we set out and we were like, hey, what if we built a CSS and JS library that just let you write actual CSS in your JavaScript file? It sounds slightly ridiculous and preposterous, but actually that might be a really good way of distributing the CSS to people, because it would allow us to use all the power of CSS while still people who install the component library to not have to worry about Webpack loaders and all of that complexity. And very quickly, the other part we realized also at the time is that this is, you know, very early on in React evolution, right? This style components came out in 2016, I believe, October 2016. So this was like 2-3 years into React being a publicly available open source project. It was very early. And the other innovation that we saw take sort of the industry, or the pattern that we saw take the industry by steam, was this concept of having style components, having a component called a column, having a component called a row. And often these components didn't do much other than render a div or a span and attach a class name, right? A column component doesn't really have to do much more than that. But that became a really popular pattern in the React world because it just feels really nice to use, right? And so then the other innovation that we coupled with letting you write actual CSS in JavaScript is that we let you write actual CSS in JavaScript, but rather than having you deal with class names, you had to create a component for every single sort of style that you create. You had to encapsulate it in a component, like a column, like a row, like a button. And Glenn and I played around with a bunch of different API ideas and ended up with this sort of styled.div and then a tag template literal API that allowed you to write literal CSS syntax in your JavaScript file. And that was extremely controversial, of course, because you're now mixing two programming languages in one file, similar to what React had done with HTML by moving it into JavaScript. We did a very similar thing with CSS. We moved it into JavaScript and into components. And half of the industry hated us. I got so much vitriol for when we announced style components, because people were like, how can you put CSS in JavaScript? That is ridiculous. That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. The browser is a different thing. The browser is optimized for having that as a separate file. Like, why mess with that? You're just making it worse. And the other half of the audience actually tried it and went, holy smokes, this feels so much better to use than any other way I've ever written CSS, because I don't have to worry about the stupid cascade anymore. I don't have to worry about class names clashing on anymore. I immediately can find the CSS that's affecting my component. I don't have to go dig through some CSS file 50 files down. And so it turns out that half of the audience was actually the one that tried it, turned out to be like, hey, I love this. I have some performance problems with it. You know, I'm missing some APIs to handle these edge cases, but overall, I love it and I want to make this a thing. And so it ended up growing really quickly. And to go back to that, sort of the quick summary of that story, to go back to your question of what we did that made it grow, I think it's really two things that helped style components become very popular. One, or three things, I should say. The two things that we had controlled over were, one, we focused very heavily on making it feel really nice to use. And in fact, often the initial response that people had was like, this is stupid. And then I would always just say, go try it. Just go build like a component with it. And inevitably, I think 100% of the time people tried it and went, well, actually, it's kind of stupid, but it feels really nice. I actually like using this thing, you know? And then the other thing that we really focused heavily on, that I think a lot of people in the open source space miss, a lot of developers in the open source space miss, is that before we released it, I probably spent 20% of my time writing code and 80% of my time writing documentation. We shipped with an immense set of documentation comparatively to how long we worked on the code, because I knew that if people, even if it feels nice to use and it's somewhat intuitive, right, if people get stuck, they're not going to want to use it, right? So we needed to have the documentation to support people actually doing most of the common things that they needed to do. And we got to, you know, 80, 90% of covering what people needed to do. And then the other thing I always say is, when you're building something new, focus on making it work fast, then make it right, and then make it fast. Any other way doesn't work, because you have to make it work fast and ship it fast, because then you get feedback, right? Immediately we got feedback from people that was like, hey, I need these global styles, right? This component thing's great, but I have this one, you know, I want to inject normalized CSS through style components as well. I have some of these global styles that I just need. So we needed to add an API for that. And there's many examples, like theming. People were like, oh, I need a slightly different theming API, and the way theming works doesn't really make sense to me. Like, I have this use case, can you support it? And so through that feedback, first making it work, then we were able to make it right, right? Because we got the feedback, because we got people to come back to us, we were able to iterate on the library and add APIs and iterate on the APIs that we had shipped initially to make it a really solid, complete experience. And then finally, once it was right, once we knew we had APIs that were stable and we were pretty complete, then we could focus on making it fast, right? But if we had made the old APIs fast, we would have wasted a whole bunch of time because they turned out to be the wrong APIs in the first place. And so it would have just been a pure waste of time. So always make it work, make it right, make it fast. And then finally, and this is something maybe that is not as easily reproducible, we were just in the right place at the right time, right? The React was gaining immense steam and growing really quickly. And everybody that was using React essentially didn't really have a solution for CSS. Everybody was using global CSS. CSS modules came around and was sort of a first solution, but that had problems attached to it that some people didn't want to deal with. And so then style components became the solution to those problems and fundamentally just overtook because as React grew, style components just kind of grew with it. So we also just got lucky on the timing, I think, is a big part of it that I don't want to just, you know, I don't want to be like, oh yeah, we built a great library and we wrote documentation and then, you know, whenever you do that, it's going to be success. No, you also have to have good timing and you have to solve a really important problem to people at that time, right? So there was a lot of timing and luck involved as well.
I really like what you said about the effort put into documentation. That is so easy to be overlooked. Like there are so many people out there that simply they have the best solution that exists out there, or at least they think they do. But you just don't know how to use it. There is just no documentation. Like I am also the host of Adventures in Angular, which is a podcast focused on Angular development. And one particular feature of Angular that I absolutely love is something called Control Value Assessor. It's a native way inside the Angular framework for you to create components that control an input, just like a regular input. So it's a way for you to create components that are meant to be used in forms. And it's brilliant. It's so flexible. It's so powerful. And it's so undocumented. There is literally no documentation about it in the entire official docs of Angular. Like the only thing that you can see is the actual docs of the API itself, but there's no guide on how to use it, how to extend this functionality. Every article that exists about it is from other creators in the internet that saw the power of that feature and created content about it. And it came to a point where every senior Angular developer knows about this feature and there's still no mention about it. The guides of the docs is crazy. Like everybody sees the value in it, but it's just not documented. So I really want to hammer this down. It's so important for any of you that is currently creating a library or thinking about creating a library. If you are going to publicly share this library with the open source community, you need good documentation. Like, it's just currently this is a requirement because there are so many other libraries that get this right currently that there's just no space for you to ignore this. But at the same time, there are so many others ignoring it that just by doing this, you're narrowing your competitors so much. So definitely do that. And if you're doing something internally, it's also interesting to consider just documentation, just doc generators and just using regular JS docs and TS docs in your functions. You obviously don't need to write an entire getting started for internal libraries, but if you could at least document the main functions and how they should be used, like put up some examples in it, that's definitely valuable, not just for open source projects, but also for internal projects. So yeah, excellent, excellent mention. Go ahead.
If I may interject for just a hot second, the thing about documentation is that people often think they need to be write down how the library works. But that's actually the part you don't need to write down because that's the part that doesn't matter. But if you think about style components, it's a CSS and JS library. So the thing that it does internally that's sort of the difficult and gnarly part of style components and implementing is it takes the CSS that you write in your JavaScript file, it parses it because it's written in actual CSS language, and then it compiles it into it sort of handles tag template literals, injects the props and the theming, compiles it to the set of styles that need to apply to this HTML element, creates a unique class name, injects it into the style sheet, into the DOM, and then also manages the cascade as to how those things relate to each other, particularly as it relates to inheritance, style components has some inheritance features that require us to manage the cascade in a certain way so that they work the way they should. None of that is documented. If you look at the style components documentation, it doesn't talk about any of that, because the whole point of it is that you don't have to think about it, right? The whole point is you just write your CSS in JavaScript and we figure out how to get it to the right place and get you the result that you expect based on the API, right? The whole point is you don't have to care about it. If we had written documentation that was like, here's how style components work, here's how it injects DOM, that's the least interesting part of the documentation, right? That is valuable in its own right in terms of like, you know, documenting the architecture, getting contributors, blah, 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 blah. But that is a different purpose, right? For users, the whole point is that that is abstracted away. The whole point is that it's an abstraction where you don't have to think about any of that. You can write a certain code where you expect a certain result, and the library makes sure that the result that you get is the result that you expect. And that is the part that you need to document then, is the use cases and the examples and how do I actually use this to achieve the goal that I have. If I want to make a theme for my app where I can quickly switch between different colors and make it user customizable, how do I add that to my app, right? If I want to inject global styles because I need normalized CSS, how do I do that with style components, right? How do I make a button that switches color when it changes variant, right? All these things are the things that we documented. It's how do you use the library. And in fact, a lot of it was actually just documenting CSS features. A lot of it is like, how do I do media queries? You write a freaking media query. You know what I mean? Like, we didn't implement anything for media queries. You know, like, we didn't implement media queries or hover selectors in CSS. That's not what we do at all. We just parse the CSS and inject it. But from a user's perspective, right, when they come to the documentation, what do they want to get done? They want to create a media query, right? They got to create some mobile styles. They want to add a hover style because their button has a hover style. They want to create a variant of a button that has different colors or a different outline. That's what they care about doing. And so that's what the documentation focuses about. It's not perfect, but fundamentally think about not how does your library work and what does it do? Because that's the part that shouldn't matter. It's what is your user trying to do and how can you help them achieve that more quickly through the documentation? How can you help them achieve their goal? And that goal is hopefully not to learn about how style components are CSS injection, right? Because otherwise you've done something wrong with your library, right? And it's not abstracted enough.
That is a great point. I definitely saw some libraries explaining their internals, and I always keep that part because I'm like, I really don't care. I would much rather if you just put some benchmarks so that I can see that it is performant. That would be a lot more interesting to me. But yes, great points. Let's keep on with the storyline, Max. So cool. Now you created this library. It got a lot of traction. Currently, are you still maintaining it, or do you have other people maintaining it? Do those other developers, are they in your payroll? Like, are people that you hired and you this is one of their tasks, or did you found a way to over time completely delegate the maintenance of this library to the open source community as a whole? How was that?
Yeah, great question. So initially, Glenn and I created the library, and then a lot of the step from making it work to making it right is the part that Glenn and I focused on, building the right APIs, building the right abstractions, making sure that people could do and achieve the goals that they wanted to achieve with the library, making sure that the result was what they expected. And then over time, other contributors onboarded onto the code base because they were using it, they were loving it, and they wanted to help make it better, right? And they had their own ideas of what that meant, specifically Phil, Evan. There's a few people that have really contributed, the majority, Evan in particular, eventually then later on took over maintenance completely and did a lot of work on making it fast and sort of like improving the performance of it over time by optimizing it for the way the browsers parse JavaScript and they execute JavaScript. And so over time, my expertise and Glenn's expertise, which is, I don't want to speak for Glenn, but my expertise for sure, is around the developer experience, right? And how something can feel and be as intuitive as possible. And then I'm not an expert on JavaScript engine performance, right? I'm not an expert on how do I optimize this JavaScript code to run as efficiently as possible. I'm not an expert on how do I inject the CSS in the most efficient way possible. And that was a lot of the work that happened later. As the library gained steam, people were like, hey, look, performance is one of our concerns. And in fact, for people that were around back then, emotion was a big driver of that. Emotion came around and was like, hey, we implemented style components, but it's 2 times faster. And we were like, wait, what are they doing differently that is possible? And a lot of it was JavaScript engine optimizations and then also a more efficient way of injecting CSS. And that kickstarted a whole sort of like spur of energy around, hey, how can we make style components faster? And in fact, eventually style components ended up getting faster, and then emotionally ended up getting faster, and then style components ended up getting faster to where now performance doesn't matter anymore because all the libraries are so fast. And that's a lot of the work that Evan and Phil ended up doing, and they've completely taken over maintenance. I don't think I've written, if you look at the contributor graph, I don't think I've written a line of code for style components since maybe 2018, 2019, I want to say. It's been a long time. And in fact, the library also ended up being very stable, right? Once we had figured out the APIs and sort of like, what is the API that we want to present and what is the result that people expect from that API, there isn't that much more to do. We had to, you know, there were bugs to fix and there were, you know, certain edge cases to iron out. And again, performance was a big focus. And eventually it was just stable. Like it just worked for people, right? The people didn't really run into problems anymore. It was fast. It had all the APIs that people needed. And so the maintenance went over into really largely Evan's hands. Evan Jacobs, underscore probably up on X on Twitter, really took over a lot of the sort of like long-term maintenance over the last 5 years and has been the main person sort of like fixing all these small bugs, making improvements to the code base, making it even faster, making it more maintainable, and really pushing a lot of that forward while I ended up going and doing lots of other things. So it's really in the open source community's hands. It also never became, or we never tried to make it a business. Like it's very much an open source project that we just shipped because we thought the world needed it. We never really made any money. There's an open collective that I think over the course of the last 8 years has collected maybe $10,000 or something to that, you know, order of magnitude that we never even spent. It was very much like, we just want the open source community to have this. And so nobody was really ever paid to maintain it. I think there was once a bug bounty that we wanted fixed, and we once sent somebody to a conference, and that was the extent of it. We never really paid anybody for it. It really was very much a community thing, and sort of like ended up shifting out of my hands into people who knew more about the problems that we were facing later on. I think most interestingly, the thing that I live and try to live every day is that I default to open, and what I mean by that is, I default to being open to new experiences and new opportunities and sort of like external input and external feedback. And one of the ways that showed in my story is that after we released Style Components, this person that I had known from online, Bryn Jackson, pinged me via Twitter and was like, hey, we've been using Style Components to build this new product, but we're running into this weird bug. How can we fix it? And I just replied, I was like, hey, let me just go look at your code base. I actually don't know why this bug you're hitting is, I don't have enough context. Just give me access to the code base and I'll take a look at the code. And ended up looking at the code and that what they were building, the product they were building was called Spectrum and was a community platform for their podcast network. And I looked at it and I was like, wait, hold on. I need this for my open source communities. I need a place for them to go because at the time, Slack had just sort of kicked out all of the communities. Gitter was a thing, but it was sort of shitty, excuse me, for people that worked on Gitter. It was just not a good experience. There was no real place for open source communities to hang out. And so I ended up talking to Bryn and Brian, the two people who built Spectrum, and I was like, hey, I want to go do this with you. And I ended up co-founding that startup together with them, and we built this community platform for developers that was eventually 2 years later acquired by GitHub and turned into GitHub Discussions, right? But that came to be ostensibly through Style Components and my work on Style Components, but really came to be because I was open to new opportunities and I was open to helping people and I was open to connecting with people through that experience of having created this library, and that kickstarted a lot of my career.
That's amazing. So in a way, you were like the designer of the project. And then after you designed it and you made sure that it was what the audience wanted, it was aligned with their expectations and the best experience possible, then it's almost like you handed this design to the engineers that would maintain it, right? Of course, you actually implemented it, but just to make an analogy between design and development, it was pretty much it. That's an interesting position to be in because I think a lot of people think about projects in a way that is they have to code it, they have to architect it, implement it, and maintain. And it's always good to take a step back and realize that there are actually spaces available for every different type of professional. So you can definitely be the type of person that enjoys a lot more the architecturing and structuring the project and designing the APIs, and then kind of leaving the maintenance and the rest of the implementation to other engineers that might prefer that better and other people that we want to refactor this endlessly to make it, to extract as much performance juice and browser compatibility as possible. So So really interesting to also keep in mind that this is a possibility for people. But yeah, let's keep on with the storyline, because I'm interested in how we're now getting into your entrepreneurial opportunities, right? So you became the co-founder of Spectrum. And when did you, like, did you ever left this position? You left it after it was bought by GitHub. How did it came to be for you to be the founder of Spectrum up until the point where you are now the CEO and co-founder of Stellate?
So with Spectrum, let me start where I left off. With Spectrum, we built a product that worked well for the purposes it served, and then eventually GitHub acquired it and turned it into GitHub Discussions to help open source communities talk about things other than issues, right? Which was really previously the only main conversation piece on GitHub. After I left GitHub, eventually I joined Gatsby, the static site generator startup that built this framework based around GraphQL that helped people build static websites with Gatsby, with React and GraphQL, and really brought the main innovation to me in Gatsby at the time was really the GraphQL data layer, where you could use this data layer that could very easily tie in lots of data sources from your CMSs, from your databases, from whatever other systems you're using into one graph, and then allow you to build static sites with that graph very, very easily. And I came to Gatsby because I was working on some of their more future-looking sort of visual editing experiments. We did a lot of work around how could you build a visual editing system that is that generically solves the problem of editing React components, right? And so we had first versions of something called Blocks UI that allowed you to literally go into your browser, click on a component, and change a prop, and it would propagate back to your code base from there. Like you could literally visually edit code. You could move components around and move it around in the JSX, stuff like that. We never ended up getting that production ready because there's a lot of complexity to editing code visually. That's not a very simple problem to solve. And trying to solve the sort of biggest scope of that, which is you can edit anything, is very, very difficult. And in fact, it turns out that probably better approaches are more similar to Framer or Web Studio, if you've seen those things where you have a more constrained approach where you get to use these pre-built components and you get to move them around, but fundamentally that eventually generates code that you can deploy, but it's not a two-way sync, right? It's not a back-and-forth street. You can add your own custom components, but it's not like Framer's editing your code base, right? Because that part is really, really difficult to have humans be able to edit the code base and have a system for visual editing edit your code base. Just proved to be an immensely difficult problem. We never actually got it to work reliably enough to ship to production and make a product out of it. And then through working on Spectrum, where we were using GraphQL really heavily, and GitHub, where I was using their GraphQL API, and then Gatsby, which obviously was based around GraphQL, I had been in the GraphQL space for many, many years. And then back in 2021, I realized that at Spectrum, one of our core problems was that we were growing really quickly, but our infrastructure couldn't keep up with the growth that we had because I'd chosen a database RethinkDB that just wasn't mature enough to really scale to the scale that we were at. And so we were using GraphQL and we had, you know, a use case where lots of our data was public and read heavy. And so my immediate thought was, let me just put a cache in front of our GraphQL API because 90% of our traffic is read traffic. That traffic never actually has to hit our infrastructure, right? That doesn't have to put load on our database. But nothing existed. So I ended up building a GraphQL caching system internally that was, you know, a first MVP, but wasn't nearly as powerful as I thought a GraphQL caching system could be, because GraphQL, because of the unique ways that it works, which I'm happy to talk about too, allows you to do really, really smart caching if you can do it right, right? And GraphQL clients actually end up doing a lot of that. I ended up taking that meeting, my co-founder Tim, and he had actually built a prototype of a first GraphQL edge cache that runs at the CDN level, and we made a company out of that that's now called Stellate. So for the last 3 years, I've really been on this journey of co-founding this company and then transitioning. I built the initial product, of course, but then also transitioning out and transitioning to being a CEO, leading a team of now 14 people, and sort of like all the complexities that come with being a founder and building a team that are very different and problem sets and very different and require very different growth than what it took to be an engineer and what it took to build, you know, large open source projects and other products. And so that's really been my journey over the last, you know, whatever, 8 years, going from, hey, I'm an engineer, I build open source projects, I build products, to now running a whole organization and leading a team to hopefully success which is just requires a very different skill set. And so that's been a lot of the journey over the last 3 years, specifically with Stellate. It's both the GraphQL part and sort of like building the best product that we can to help people operate their GraphQL API, and then also building an actual company from scratch and team from scratch, you know, and all the complexities that come with that.
Awesome. Awesome. I have several questions. The first one being not directly related to your story per se, directly related to your story, but not directly about you, which is when you were working at Gatsby, did you got to meet Josh Camille?
I never met him in person, but I did meet him in person at one of our offsites, and I spoke with him a bunch of times internally, of course. Yeah.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. Just mentioning that because he is definitely one of my top 10 content creators out there. I really enjoy the quality of his content. It's really, really, really good, really simple too. So it almost feels like everyone that I see that had a background in Gatsby are excellent developers. So it seems like you guys all came from, all got together at that point. That's kind of interesting. And I'm also curious about Gatsby itself, like just from a pure curiosity, because Gatsby is, I'm not sure how Stellate is with regards to open source, but Gatsby itself is an open source solution that has a company behind it and actually generates money and pays employees. So since we're talking about entrepreneurial spirit here, how do you see tech startups that are trying to create a profitable model based on open source technology? Because I, for one, think it's probably way more challenging than just having a closed source system. Maybe there's pros and cons, right? There is a lot more traction because you have more people that get to know your product because they can just get started for free. But at the same time, if they can get started for free and most of it can be done for free, then how hard it is to actually convert them into paying customers, right? So I'm not sure if Stellate also has an open source version of it. But if so, perhaps you could even bridge Gatsby and Stellate and tell us how do you see those types of business models?
I think it's a very interesting question that a lot of people in the industry are battling with right now, because during the zero interest rate phase of the world where money was sort of free in many regards and there was a lot of investment and there was a lot of money to spend on lots of different things, that business model was more tenable than it is in 2023 and 2024, because there just isn't the same amount of money anywhere, right? Not to buy things, not to hire people, not to do much of anything, right? And in truth, pulling off an open source business model to me is in many ways more difficult than just building a business, because already just building a business that provides value and makes money is an immensely difficult task that most people fail at, right? It is unbelievably challenging to do that in the digital space, particularly because in the digital space, everything's global, right? If I'm building a local bakery, assuming I have a good, you know, I can find a good location with a rent that makes sense and I can find suppliers that charge money that allows me to have a margin that allows me to pay my employees, it's very difficult to build a local business, and you're only competing with other local businesses, right? You only have to be better than the bakery around the door. You only have to have a better location than the coffee shop around the corner. In the digital world, you're competing with the whole world, right? If you ship a product, if you're Calendly, you're now a large company that shipped the product, suddenly Savicol and Cal.com are like, hey, what if we built the same thing, but we made it nicer, or we made it more specific to certain use cases and made it work better for certain use cases? You're literally competing with the whole world. And so building a digital business, I think, is often peddled online as something that's easier. And in some ways it is, right? In some ways the friction is lower than building a physical business. There's less overhead, there's less initial costs. You often have immense margins because your cost of actually, you know, having another customer is essentially zero, right? If somebody buys a croissant, you still have to pay for that croissant. If you have software, you can sell it a million times and it doesn't cost you anything anymore, right? There's no extra cost to selling software outside of obviously the sales of it and whatever, but largely your margin is going to be insane, right? So in some ways it's easier, but in other ways it's harder because you're competing with the whole world. And I think a lot of businesses think they can, or a lot of the difficulty with building a business around open source is that it becomes very difficult to assess what goes into open source and what is paid. And you sort of a very slippery slope if you're looking to get more revenue to move features into the paid offering that you have that really should be in the open source world. And actually, that was a lot of what Gatsby ran into even before I was there. This is I have no internal information on this, but a lot of the sentiment around Gatsby was, hey, Gatsby's builds are slow, right? I have a static website with 1,000 pages, with 10,000 pages, and my site, every time I make an update, takes 4 hours to build. And so Gatsby released Gatsby Cloud, which was a Gatsby-specific hosting service that in some ways just understood Gatsby really well and data layer really well and could very efficiently do rebuilds of only the pages, incremental builds of only the stuff that actually needs to be updated. It kept track of data dependencies and on all that stuff, which is awesome. And that was a paid thing that Gatsby charged for. But then externally, the sentiment was, well, you just made me use an open source project and a static site generator that is slow, and then you're selling me it being fast. But why is it slow in the first place? Why can't that be? Why can't the open source project just be fast and you offer me hosting, right? That was often the tension that people felt with that business model, and that's very difficult to execute on. The counterexample, and I think the shining star of a company that has done this well, is Vercel, who've built Next.js, and they have a very clear sort of differentiation between what Next.js does, and they make Next.js the open source version or the open source project as good as they humanly can, and then Vercel is the platform where people host it, and through that they get, you know, preview deployments and, you know, great infrastructure and edge middlewares and all these features that they want that require infrastructure that you cannot have in an open source project, right? And so suddenly they've sort of drawn that line in a beautiful way where the community loves what they're doing with Next.js, and then a lot of them also end up deploying on Vercel, which is great for Vercel because obviously they're also a business and they need to make money. But Vercel to me is an outlier, right? There's Vercel, there's HashiCorp, there's a few other companies that do this, but most companies that do this fail. And it's because it's really, really difficult to figure out that distinction. And then also you're immediately splitting your company in half. Again, it's really difficult to build a viable business online. That's not an easy task. It's a monumental challenge that people, I think, underestimate, that I certainly underestimated. It's really freaking difficult. And suddenly you're having to build a business and then you're also having to build an open source project, right? That is an immense amount of work that you suddenly have to do with a small new company that has very few resources, right? That has to move really quickly. That's a Mount Everest to climb, you know, and that's why I think so few people ever manage to actually climb that Mount Everest. It's just because it's freaking difficult, right? It seems easy, simple, but it is immensely difficult to execute upon. And so I have a lot of respect for people that try that and that pull it off, like Vercel. And I have a lot of respect for people that try it and don't pull it off. I think that demands equally much respect because it is a really difficult challenge. Stellate specifically, we're not open source. We are a GraphQL CDN, is a way you could think about it. And so we're based around GraphQL, which is open source, obviously, and lots of people use GraphQL without Stellate. But then once they hit certain scaling problems, once they have performance problems, once they have too high infrastructure costs, once they need better observability, then they put Stellate in front of their GraphQL API, which is just our product, and they get edge caching performance benefits through that and metrics and security through using our product. But our product itself is not open source at all. It's only a paid offering. And in fact, you could argue that Stellate itself doesn't really have an open source offering because we're just based around the framework of GraphQL. And sure, we contribute to GraphQL and we build GraphQL clients and we help GraphQL and we do a lot of open source work, but it's actually kind of unrelated to our business. Our business is really a product that's fate that's built around GraphQL, and we are not, I would not describe Stellate as an open source company, even though we're sort of open source adjacent maybe, but really we're not an open source company. We're really just a business that makes a product that we sell to customers. That was a long tangent answer to your original question. I hope that made sense.
It did. So what you said is basically that the companies that, at least the ones that you saw executing this model really well are the ones that separated the products. So Vercel, for example, has different products and one of them is fully paid. Actually, they do have a free tier, but it's closed source and it's meant to be paid. And the other is open source and it is meant to be fully open sourced and fully free and fully owned and used by the community. That's interesting. Have you seen other companies that are, like you mentioned, Qalcon? I think that's a good example of a company that is open sourced, but they are generating profits, or not sure if profits, but they're generating money at least. And maybe that is because they are positioning themselves directly against a competitor that has already established himself as a fully paid solution, right? So Qalqon even publicly positions themselves as an alternative to Calendly that is also open source. So if you are already a user of Calendly, you already have this previous expectation that it's going to be this way. Also, it's just so much harder for you to, it's so much easier for you to just click on a button and create a cloud account than it is for you to actually host the entire thing on your own services, even if you can just get a droplet on DigitalOcean and put it up and running. It's still a little bit more effort and you actually have to maintain it. It's different from a technology that you're going to introduce in your code base and you're already going to have to maintain your code base anyways. So it's not like you're adding too much of a burden in terms of maintenance. But Qalqon, for example, it's a full standalone product that if you were to integrate it, it would probably be via API calls directly to a hosted instance, which is completely different from just an open source library that you're going to integrate in a larger code base that is proprietarily yours. So I think that's also one difference in that. So we have here examples of companies that did it right by completely separating the products. We have an example of a company that got it right by having a single product that is open source, but it is standalone. It's a standalone product. Now, just open sourced code bases that also have a paid version and they are meant to be used within your proprietary code base, I can literally only think of one, which I think is very, very clever, and it is Boo MQ. It's a library for you to connect to a Redis instance and generate an asynchronous queue. So you can just use it to create microservices. And what they did is they created a fully free open source version of the library. And they created a pro version that requires a license. But this pro version has a few advanced features that are particularly interesting for companies that want to extract a little bit more from their queues. So for example, they have groups. So you can't have grouped queues in the free version. You need to pay to get that. So that it's like you literally have a plan, right? You have the free plan and then you have the pro plan. And the pro plan is not open sourced at all. And we're not talking about making it faster. We're talking about not having something and now you have it. So perhaps that's one difference from Gatsby. It's not making it, it's not a feature that is just about making it faster. It's about adding support for one way of doing things that was simply not possible in the free version.
I sort of have a hot take on businesses like Qalqon, which is I think they are successful despite being open source, not because they're open source. My guess is that, you know, because there's a whole swath of these products now like Qal.com, like Documento, which is a, you know, DocuSign alternative that's open source. A lot of people are trying to be, you know, I'm going to build this product that's really successful, but I'm going to make it open source. In truth, though, that has some advantages, right? It comes with great marketing, particularly, you know, indie hackers and software engineers. We love these open source products. We can look at the code base. It feels cool to use. Like, it's nice that it's open source. It's awesome. It has some marketing benefits. It also has some benefits in terms of, like, making it easier to sell that solution into governments, into healthcare, into these industries where there's a lot of security and data requirements that are hard to meet otherwise if you're a proprietary product. But if you have a source, open source, then it might be easier to get into those industries. I think the thing that I'm not sure about is how often do these use cases end up paying you, because if they're just self-hosting it on their government cloud infrastructure, how do you make money off of that, right? Like, I don't really see what the benefit is there, but I don't have enough context. But I think the downside is actually you don't have a competitive advantage compared to your competitors outside of those specific use cases, because fundamentally, if cal.com is open source, but a shitty version of Calendly, people are still going to be using Calendly, right? The product has to be better than what other competitors can offer in order for you to win in the market. The open, like making a shittier version of Calendly, making it open source, in no way, shape, or form is going to help you win in the market. There's no way that you're going to win a lot of revenue through that approach, right? You have to build a better product than Calendly. Now, the other part of that is building a better product than a large established competitor. In some ways, it's easy, and in some ways, it's really hard. And one of the ways that it's really hard is that you have to be, the only way that I see companies like win at sort of like taking over niches of from established competitors is that they choose niches. They choose a use case, an audience, a persona that is very specific. Where Calendly works for everybody. And then SavvyCal came around and was like, hey, we're for people that want Calendly, but it looks nice, right? That was sort of the initial framing that they had, right? It's like, it works nice. It integrates your calendar. The user experience is great for both you and for people that schedule links. So if you don't want to look shitty like Calendly, go use us and you will have a better impression with the people that you schedule meetings with. That was sort of the initial pitch. Now it's shifted a little bit, but that was the initial pitch and that was the initial wedge into the market. Whether or not SavvyCal is open source doesn't matter to that pitch. It's completely irrelevant. They could have attached and were open source at the end and it wouldn't have mattered, right? Because to them, what mattered was they chose a persona, which is design-oriented people that like good user experience. And they were like, hey, Calendly sucks in this way. We're going to build a version of Calendly that works great in this way. And the other part of that is too, if you're doing that, you have to let go of a lot of the other stuff that Calendly does, right? Calendly doesn't have a shitty user experience and looks ugly because they want to look ugly. They have a shitty user experience and they look ugly because they realize that for their business, it's more important to focus on other things, right? Because everybody has constrained resources. And so for Calendly, it was more important to build SOC 2 compliance. It was more important to build data compliance. It was more important for them to build global deployments. It was more important for them to build enterprise single sign-on because that is their audience, right? And so they just realized their resources are better spent. I have no internal context on Calendly. I'm making this up, but I'm assuming they realize their internal resources are better spent on all these enterprise features than on making the user experience better because the market for the enterprise features was just so much larger. And SavvyCal came around and was like, well, we're just going to ignore all the enterprise stuff. We're only going to focus on user experience. We're going to take this niche. We're going to take this slice of your market away from you. We're going to take over that specific wedge and we're going to win in the market for that persona that way. The fact that cal.com is open source is not helping them win. It doesn't matter, right? If it was a worse product, people would still be choosing SavvyCal or Calendly. But cal.com in some ways is better. Now, the big downside of being open source is that suddenly you have a lot of people contributing a lot of crap. Excuse my language. If any of you have ever contributed or run a large open source project, the amount of terrible contributions that people propose are immense. The amount of issues that you get that are complete crap is immense. Like, it is a lot of work to manage large open source projects, in large part because a lot of people think they can grow their career through contributing to open source, which is great and it's true, and then they just submit bullshit contributions so that they can say they contributed to Node.js or to React or to whatever, right? That is a very common pattern that is very frustrating for open source maintainers. Now, for cal.com, that means that I'm sure they're spending a lot of resources on managing their issues, on managing their pull requests, on managing external contributors, on submitting bounties, on giving feedback. And then in turn, though, they also have to be very strict about saying no. Because I'm sure what's happening is that a lot of people are submitting contributions for their use cases, for their thing that they need from cal.com. What in turn means, though, that cal.com's feature set is just going to explode and be everything for nobody, right? They're just going to end up being, if they're not careful, they're just going to solve all the problems for no specific audience, for no specific persona. And then in the end, they're going to be a worse product, right? So they have to spend a lot more time on actually product managing the contributions that external people are making who have no idea what cal.com is doing, right? Many of them won't have the time or resources or interest to dig into, you know, cal.com's persona definition and what is the audience that they're targeting and what is their product roadmap and how do these features align with their product roadmap and why do they want to have these features and how do they think about their product philosophy? If all of that's very clearly defined and documented, then maybe, but even just documenting all of that and defining all of that is a lot of effort, right? And so to me, looking at cal.com, if they win in the market, the reason they will win in the market is not because they're open source. To me, the reason they're going to win in the market is despite them being open source almost. At best, I think it's a neutral thing that they can do and it gives them some marketing. But I don't see a world in which they win because they're open source. Now, I would love for Pierre Rich to come around and tell me I'm completely wrong and I'm an idiot and I'm completely missing the point. That would be awesome. But in my view, I don't understand why they would win in the market because they're open source. That to me is just not a thing. And so I think to go back to your differentiation, there's businesses built around open source libraries and frameworks like Versus or Next.js, like Gatsby was around Gatsby.js, the framework. And there's a few other examples of this. And then there's a category of businesses that open source their whole product, right? GitLab being the most famous large scale one. But again, GitLab, maybe if they... like, if they had built a better version of GitHub, maybe they would have won in the market. They lost. GitHub clearly took over, at least in the open source world, right? They're the predominant co-sorting platform on the platform, in the world. I don't know what the specific distribution of like market share is, but there's no way that GitLab has even close to the same market share that GitHub does. If they had built a better product than GitHub, maybe they would have won. Them being open source, they didn't win. You know what I mean? Like, they didn't even win the open source community by being open source. All of the open source stuff happens on GitHub. I don't want to know this. I don't know the statistic, but I'm 100% certain that 90-95% of open source packages on NPM are hosted on GitHub, not on GitLab. GitLab itself, the product is open source and nobody cares, right? They built the worst product and they didn't win. Like, for that category of business, you just have to build a better product. That's all that ultimately matters to me. Whether or not your open source is sort of an implementation detail and maybe a marketing thing, but it doesn't make the big difference in you winning in a market or not, outside of maybe, you know, government healthcare and all that stuff. But I don't see it. And so to me, the true open source businesses are the ones that are building around an open source framework and whose success is attached to the success of that open source framework. That is, to me, a true open source business. Not in like some, you know, I don't care if you call yourself an open source business or not, but to me, the riskier thing is Vercel basing their whole business on their freaking Next.js framework. If Next.js stops working, Vercel has a huge problem, right? If cal.com's GitHub repo stops getting stars, it doesn't matter. If they've built a better product, people will still buy it. You know, it's completely irrelevant to the success of their business. To Vercel, though, if people stop using Next.js and start adopting something else that is better deployed somewhere else, holy smokes, that is a huge risk to their business. You know, same thing with Gatsby.js, because Gatsby stopped getting a lot of adoption in the market. Gatsby Cloud only had a very limited market to sell to, and so the revenue potential wasn't there, right? Fundamentally, because more people started using Next.js for various reasons that I'm happy to talk about. But, like, that is a core risk to your business suddenly. For cal.com, for GitLab, whether or not people look at their open source core is completely irrelevant. The thing that matters is, have they built a better product? Sorry for the rant. That was a hot take that I've been sitting on for a while. But so apologies for the tangent, but I just don't see it.
No worries, no worries. I definitely appreciate it. It's always good to listen to the opinions of other people that have been thinking about this for a while. It's really interesting to think about, like, you said Calcom is gaining traction despite being open source, right? I think that I disagree with this in parts, just in the specific case of Calcom. I'm not generalizing it, but for Calcom specifically, I believe that they did got a lot of traction, and still most of the traction that they have are developers that just thought it was nice that they were doing it open source and got interested and decided to use it because of that. But it's just a branding and marketing positioning. It's not really an operational advantage. As you were saying, they probably spend a lot more time trimming down and filtering the work that their open source contributors are doing then actually directing the product and the company to where they would like it to go. And there's also so much more exposure for everything that they do. Like, there are so many downsides, but at the same time, this level of visibility, I think, created a very specific brand for them that made other developers resonate with their mission. It's almost as if people are using Calcom not because it is better than the alternatives, but because they emotionally like what they are trying to do. So I do think that they are growing because of them being open source, not despite of it. But I also think that this is going to eventually become a problem, because unless their target audience is only developers or very tech-savvy people that care about the open source community, then at some point they're going to have to consider closing the source. And this is, if that happens, it's going to generate so much frustration. I remember there was this company that had open source designs for 3D printers. I think it was MakerBot. I don't know. It was something like that. I don't know if you guys recall it, but they had a 3D printer, and they had all the project information, how you can build it, how the software, everything was open sourced and anyone could build on top of it. And then they started actually having competitors that were building products based on their specifications. And the competitors were just closed source, right? It's just like OpenAI. At some point, it's going to bite you, you know? Oh, okay, we have this mission of making AI open. And now you just have a company that is called OpenAI, but there's no open model in it. So at some point, it becomes a communication problem because you keep getting reminded of how you got to the point that you got, like how you found your initial product market fit. And then suddenly at some point you decide to turn around something that was so core in your positioning, in your messaging, in your brand. And it definitely hurts. And it hurts kind of forever because that was how it started and then it changes. So also curious, like, do you have any takes on companies that start open source and then eventually become closed source?
I think this goes back to what I was talking about earlier. And then sort of like one of my main learnings over the last 3 years of being a co-founder and a CEO and sort of transitioning from an engineering role, building a business that makes money, really freaking difficult. It is extremely hard to do that. And in many ways for these companies at scale, like even recently Redis Labs, right, realized that their business was at risk of just flatly dying because the other companies were taking the open source projects that they invested so much money into and then hosted it and made a better hosting version of Redis Labs, which makes total sense, right? If you just think about it from a purely logical sense, Redis Labs has to invest n number of resources to make Redis great, and then they can only invest, you know, X number of resources to make Redis Labs the hosting great. Everybody else can ignore the end part. They don't have to make Redis great because Redis Labs is doing that. They can invest n plus X, the whole resources, just to make the hosting great. And so inevitably, and totally logically speaking, their hosting will be better than Redis Labs, right? Redis Labs has no way of competing because they don't have the same amount of resources. Now, this is very simplified, of course. Truly, in a market, it often works differently. There's, you know, many confounding factors, whatever. I don't want to pretend like the world works in this oversimplified way, but just purely logically speaking, you just end up in a situation as a business where you literally cannot compete, right? How are you going to do that? And so, in fact, many businesses like Sentry as well, like Redis Labs, they're moving to a model where the source is available, right? It's a source available model where you can read the source code of the thing and you can use it for non-commercial use. But if you want to use it for commercial use, especially, and then there's some nuances there where, you know, some open source projects are like, you can even use it for commercial uses in, like, in your business, you can host it yourself, but you cannot sell a hosted version to somebody else, right? Because often what ended up happening with these businesses is AWS would come around, they would just take your code, offer a service, a paid service of it, and just eat your whole business because everybody uses AWS and they don't want to onboard a new vendor, right? And that's it. Again, going back to building a business is freaking hard. That is an existential risk for your business. That is an existential risk for any business, right? If AWS suddenly comes around and is like, oh, thank you for building this great open source project, we're just going to offer the same hosting service, you have no way to compete because AWS has all the customers. So they can just go to all their customers and they can be like, we're at scale. We can make this cheaper. It's much easier for you to do because you don't have to onboard a new vendor. And your whole business scale goes out of business, right? Like, you literally don't have a choice. And so to me, it's unsurprising and makes a lot of sense to see a lot of these businesses moving to source available licenses that restrict either commercial usage or just making a hosted service out of the thing outside of the business that makes it. It makes a ton of sense to me. And now with, for example, Redis Labs, in truth, the competition that they're now running into, like Upstash, I don't know if you folks have seen Upstash. Upstash just completely re-implemented Redis on a completely different architecture that's faster and better and edge compatible and in some ways just more modern. And so now Redis Labs has to compete with Upstash on who can build the better Redis, right? And Upstash is building really Upstash. It just happens to use the Redis API. But fundamentally, they're now competing at that level. And there's a timing question here, but if they had made Redis source available from the start, then they wouldn't even have had to compete with other Redis hosting services. They would only have had to compete with businesses on an even footing where every business has to build the Redis thing itself, right, the actual storage engine, and then build the hosted service on top of that. Every business would have, AppStash is competing in that way, and Redis Labs is competing in that way. That's a fair, under air quotes, fight as far as fights. The market's never fair, but you know what I'm saying. So to me, that makes a lot of sense. I can totally see why businesses have to do that and why even companies that are very, very successful, like HashiCorp, There were recent news that they're looking to get acquired by another company because they're just running into market issues by being built around these open source projects, and somebody else can build Terraform Cloud around Terraform, but doesn't have to invest the resources into building Terraform, right? Again, HashiCorp has to invest all these resources into making Vault and Nomad and Hut and Terraform, and then build hosted services on top of that, which is great for branding, but then if somebody else comes around and just focuses on the hosted services, they can outcompete them on the product, and people will generally choose the better product in many ways. Not always in it that, you know, HashiCorp gets a lot of advantage of being the people that make the thing, and so people trust them more, whatever. There's a lot of confounding factors, but broadly speaking, if you can make a 10x better Terraform hosting platform because you can invest all your resources into making the hosted platform versus making Terraform better, very likely many people will buy you just because you're the better product, and they will go, hey, I'm using Terraform, let me look at Terraform Cloud, but also there's this new upstart vendor that I've heard about that might be better. Oh, actually, there's so much better for our use case, I'm just going to pay for them, even though they're not HashiCorp. So I totally get it. I totally get why businesses do that. And I think it's the right choice.
So I think there's one exception I can think of. And I guess I should also say I'm also still... I think we could probably talk about this for hours, like the open source versus closed source thing. I don't know which is better, but a huge exception that I can think of is Supabase, right? And I think they even had one of like the world record of, if there is such a thing, for like seed funding round. And I think it depends on the product. Like, I agree. If you offer like an open source tool where you can just, I don't know, like I'm saying like NPM install something and that is the product, then you're at high risk that basically someone will just hire a dev and do whatever they want with your product, right? They can always go faster than that if you're the one who has to fight the triage of issues and all this stuff. But with something like Supabase, I really think it depends on the nature of what the product is. And in their case, it's if anyone has done this before, it's like a series of Docker images. Like, you can really recreate their entire cloud offering product on your own instance, but you have to install like Kong, which is like a more modern Nginx. You have to install their UI container, and anybody who knows like the pain of doing that, I think a lot of companies may even go so far like, hey, we can do the open source version of this, but we need like, I don't know, 3 weeks, 3 devs, and we have to configure everything. So I think if companies stay like kind of, how should I say, like crafty with how they offer their open source tooling, of course you're always on the edge. Of course you're always going to have people who will just copy it and reuse it. But I think that's only on the margin. And like for me, like I have a paid, like the mini Supabase instance, just because I don't want to go through the whole thing, like the tooling of doing that. So yeah, I'm only whatever, $25 a month. So I'm not a huge consumer, but I can imagine for larger, much more large corporations, they'd be more than happy to pay for whatever they have some enterprise offering. So, but yeah, I don't know. I think you could talk about this and argue forever, because I also like the one product that I have that is profitable is closed source. So I'm experimenting right now with open source. So maybe I'll be eating my words in a few months once there's like 20 clones of my product somewhere and I'm not getting any money. So,
oh boy. Yeah. And we are at 1 hour and 4 minutes of show already. So I imagine that we will soon start wrapping things up, but I really want to give you, Max, a space for you to talk more about your current company, because I do think that I'm not just giving you space to promote yourself just because of that, but because I actually believe it's very valuable for the audience that is listening to this. So please sell your company to us, dude. Like, I do think it's a really great idea. So tell us a little bit more about the problems that you solve and how does it work?
Yeah, thank you. Broadly speaking, lots of companies, especially at the enterprise level, are adopting GraphQL as their central API. And many of these businesses, particularly for us, we largely see e-commerce and news, retail, and media organizations, they have use cases where they have lots of public and read-heavy data, right? If you think about an e-commerce web shop, everybody's looking at the same shoe. If you're thinking about a news website, everybody's looking at the same article, right? That data is very public. It's very read-heavy. It doesn't change very frequently. And so by putting us our GraphQL CDN in front of your GraphQL API, we can cache those responses at the edge really close to the user. And that has really three main benefits. One is it's much cheaper. Some of our customers literally have 99% cache hit rates, meaning their origin infrastructure has to handle 99% less traffic because we just respond with the result from the edge immediately that we have cached. Now, that in turn means that they can reduce their infrastructure significantly. And in fact, they save 30-40% of the infrastructure costs just by pure virtue of having us in the front and caching all the data at the edge. And then the other part is traffic spike handling, because if you think about a news website, for example, if everybody's reading the same article, it's very spiky traffic, right? If something happens, if some tragedy happens, then the news website, we've got an immense traffic spike on that specific article. And everybody's looking at that same article. Now, by default, your origin infrastructure has to handle that traffic spike, right? And many news organizations just keep their infrastructure scaled up to the maximum so that when the traffic spike comes in, which is when their business makes money, they can handle the traffic spike. But in truth, all of that traffic is almost always accessing the same data, right? And so fundamentally, if you can cache that at the edge, your origin doesn't even notice the traffic spike because we handle it for you, right? You literally don't have to worry about traffic spikes anymore. And then finally, of course, the main benefit from the edge caching is performance that a lot of developers love, where because it's at the edge, we can serve a cached result to your users in about 35 to 50 milliseconds, no matter where you are on the planet, right? And so if you have your origin infrastructure sitting in US East 1 in AWS, that even if your users are in Italy or they're in Australia or they're in Asia or they're in North America or they're in South America, it doesn't matter. If something's cached, they're going to get it within about 30 to 50 milliseconds, depending on their internet connection. It's just going to be ridiculously fast. And the interesting thing, I think, for a lot of people that are listening, of course, if you are an e-commerce or a news organization, you use GraphQL, please come talk to us. We'd love to figure out if our products could work for you. But really, the interesting thing is that a lot of what we do is only possible because of GraphQL, right? One of the sort of historical, if you look at any article online that's comparing REST to GraphQL, almost always you will see REST is great for caching and GraphQL sucks for caching. And the truth is actually much more nuanced than that. In fact, GraphQL in many ways is better for caching than REST because it tells us what data is in the response. It tells us through its introspectability what is the actual data that's coming back for this query. And so that allows us to do things like partial query caching. We can, at the edge, loop through your cache rules or your cache configuration, figure out which parts of this query are how cacheable, make them distinct cache entries, and then only have to fetch the data from the origin to fulfill the rest of the data that we don't have in the cache yet, right? That is literally impossible with REST. We can do really smart caching validation because when a mutation passes through us, we know exactly what data has changed, and so we can invalidate only the specific cache entries that contain that specific data. And it's not like, oh yeah, if a post request for slash user comes in, then invalidate the corresponding get for slash user. It's much more advanced than that because when a mutation comes in for edit user, we know every single query that fetched the blog post author that was written by that user. We know every single query where the user settings were fetched for that user, and we can invalidate only and exactly that within about 150 milliseconds globally. And again, that's only possible because GraphQL tells us what data we're actually caching, right? What objects, what entities are in the data that was fetched and that are cached at the edge and that are changing over time. And so a lot of the things that we do are, we've really built the most advanced API caching solution. It just happens to be GraphQL specific because GraphQL allows us to build this advanced API caching solution. And through the way GraphQL works, we can do a lot of things that otherwise wouldn't be possible. And so we're focused on GraphQL simply because it allows us to build the best product. And because we love GraphQL, quite frankly, like as an organization, everybody that works here loves GraphQL. We've all used GraphQL at large scale. And we freaking love it. And then later on, so that's what we started with. And then later on, also, we added now GraphQL metrics that give you very GraphQL specific insights into the operations you're seeing in production, into what types and fields are how used or how slow and how many errors you're getting, very specific error tracking for GraphQL. And then also now we've shipped security features around GraphQL, both for sort of common exploits like aliases and depth and all kinds of limits, but also persistent operations and rate limiting to sort of help you protect your GraphQL API in many ways, similarly to what you would do with the REST API, but very GraphQL specific, again, with a deep understanding of GraphQL and how it works. And so that's really, if you're using GraphQL at scale, if you're running into operationalizing issues, either because you have large traffic spikes in your news organization or because you don't have the observability that you need or you're getting malicious actors trying to DDoS your API, come talk to us. We've built products around GraphQL. Going back to the open source point, our products are fully proprietary. We'll build around GraphQL, but come talk to us. Go use our CDN in front of your GraphQL API, and we'll happily solve those problems for you.
So just to make sure I get this right, Max, and first off, congratulations on the product. It's definitely a major thing, and I can only imagine how long it took for you guys to build this thing and the effort that it takes to actually maintain it. So congrats for that. My question is just to make sure that I fully understand the product. So from your description, my understanding is that it's kind of like Cloudflare in the sense that it's a proxy that sits on top of your API. And on an application layer, it can interpret the GraphQL requests, parse that query, and figure out in a smart way which parts of that query can be cached or not. And then the parts that can be cached, it already returns directly without even going to your API. And if it can't be cached, then it goes to your API, waits for the response, saves that response in a cache database that I don't even need to care about, and then returns that to the end user. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And if you think about, you know, a REST API, you have an endpoint like /get/users/1. If you have some of that user data cached from another query, that doesn't help you in caching the /get/users/1 route, right? That's a completely distinct endpoint that returns opaque data where you don't know what it is. With GraphQL, we can know exactly when you're fetching user number one whether or not we have that cache entry already, and we can just return that immediately without even having to go ask the origin. And on top of that, if you're fetching, say, users, and in one query you're fetching some of the data, and then another query you're fetching more of the data, we can know that we have some of the data in the cache already and take those fields out of the GraphQL query and only send a request for everything else that we need to the origin, because GraphQL allows us to select the exact fields that we need to fulfill the data requirements, right? And so we can do essentially the most efficient API level caching that you can do at that layer, because we have full control over which fields do we have in the cache, how have we cached them, and how do we get the rest of the fields from the origin. So yeah, you're totally right.
Nice. I really like the end user experience of it, and I really like how it doesn't force me to conform to any specific way of writing my APIs. I can just do whatever I'm used to and build my APIs in whatever way I want to, and then put your service on top of it. That's pretty cool. Nice.
Thank you.
Okay. And to which types of businesses do you think this is more interesting? Because, well, I imagine that anyone that has a GraphQL API could benefit from it, probably, right? Like, there's no specific use case besides having your API built on GraphQL. But what if I am just not so close to the edge of technology yet and I'm not built on GraphQL? Is there any way for me to still extract value from your solution, or is it really just GraphQL specific?
It's really GraphQL specific. And it's, like I said, a lot of what we do, we couldn't actually do any other way. Like, we couldn't do for REST APIs. We really have to go figure that out for GraphQL. And it really only works with GraphQL. So the kind of companies that we deal with are large organizations that use GraphQL at a really large scale. And for the edge caching, it's businesses that have, you know, very... whatchamacallit, read heavy and public traffic. And then for the metrics and the security, it's just any company that uses GraphQL and that doesn't have the observability they need or the security that they need to protect from malicious actors.
Gotcha. Okay. I just sent the link to Stellate on the comment section. So if you're listening to the show from a player that doesn't have a comment section, just know that it's Stellate.co. So Stellate.co with 2 L's. You can also just search online for Stellate, Max Stoiber, and Google is going to somehow figure out what it is that you typed and point you in the right direction. So yeah, definitely check it out if you're working with GraphQL APIs. Guys, I think we can start wrapping things up. So unless, Max, you have anything that you would like to say that you haven't yet, that you think it's really important?
I will just say thank you for letting me rant about a whole bunch of different tangents. I don't know that this went in the direction that any of you expected here, this podcast, given that the title was Style Components. We went a bit broader than that, but I hope it was insightful to people, and I hope you all enjoyed. I certainly enjoyed the conversation. I hope your listeners will too.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't think that people looking at the title of the episode are going to grasp the entire context. But yeah, thank you for those rants. Like, it's actually really good that you were so open to sharing your opinion, because oftentimes people just don't want to share those rants in a public content such as this. So I definitely appreciate your honest opinion about such topics. So yeah, let's start wrapping things up. Let's do a quick round of promos. So we can do you for last, Max, but I'm pretty confident that you kind of already did your promo. But in any case, if you want to promote other stuff, you can definitely do that. So starting on my end, really nothing major, just gonna promote the companies producing the show. So for any of you that want to learn more about software development, you can check out the other content produced by Top and Devs. There are several other podcasts that Top and Devs produces, and there are also courses that they offer. So yeah, definitely check out the website topanddevs.com if you're interested in that. And unvoid.com is unvoid.com. So the opposite of void, unvoid. Some people think that is on in terms of like on and off, but it's UN. And they offer task-based design and software development services. So the difference being that whenever you need to hire external professionals to do work for your company, you generally have to pay them by the hour. And that incentivizes them to just take their time because they're going to get more money, right? So Unvoid completely flips that business model by making sure that the clients only pay after the tasks are delivered and approved, and the clients know beforehand how much the tasks are going to cost, because Unvoid estimates points for each task and the clients pay on top of this point estimation. So clients get cost previsibility, and they also get quality assurance because they can just request changes until they're happy with what is delivered. So if you're interested in that, definitely check out unvoid.com. These are just going to be my promos for this episode. So Peter, do you have anything you'd like to mention? Okay. How about you, Chris? Anything new?
Yep. Yeah, I'm just going to post something from Superbase. The founder posted, I mean, you can take it with a grain of salt. Maybe it is all marketing, but he talks about if you should open source your company. I think it's interesting. And then the product I've been working on, I've posted it quite a bit the last few weeks. I actually recently got into the finalist stage. I don't know if you guys have heard of Backdrop Build before. So it was like 1,000 or so devs or so, and they pick like 50 finalists. But you can, it's basically a declarative way to create software engineering videos, perhaps later other types of videos. But over the weekend, I got the API endpoint up. So it's not on that website yet, but it'll be up soon. Basically, you can think about it from a very high level. You give JSON to an endpoint and you get an animated video, like a lifelike animated video of, you know, dictating whatever you're coding or whatever you're building back as a MP4 URL. So
pretty cool, dude. And I sent all those links in the show notes in the comment section. So definitely check it out if you're interested in that. So Max, just circling back to you, is there anything else you'd like to promote?
Well, I sure hope I didn't upset any open source founders that are listening to this episode. I would love to hear a contrarian take, and I'm definitely going to check out that Superbase article. I'm very curious how they thought about open sourcing their company. I have nothing else to plug. Go check out Stellate if you're using GraphQL. I'm at MXSDBR on all platforms, Twitter, GitHub, Instagram, wherever you want to follow people, even Blue Sky, Mastodon, whatever, at MXSDBR, which is my name, which looks really complicated, but it's really just my name without vowels. So you can find me anywhere. And thank you all so much for having me.
Thank you very much, Max. Feel free to join and rant a little bit more about other subjects whenever you want. And congratulations on your company. I hope you are very successful. I'm pretty sure it will be, because everything else that you've worked on thus far has been. So I'm pretty excited about the next steps in this journey. So yeah, man, congrats, and feel free to hit me up if you want to join the podcast any other time. Thank you.